good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in. So there's something weird going on, what is becoming a very public spat between the government of Israel and the government of the United States, and it has to do with Condoleezza's abstention vote in the UN Security Council last Thursday. Yeah, last Thursday. That was a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, which both Hamas and Israel have rejected. But the story is that Ehud Olmert, the prime minister, in a speech yesterday in Ashkelon in Israel, said that Condoleezza Rice had been embarrassed when she was ordered to back down from supporting the resolution she had prepared after the Israeli Prime Minister Olmert intervened with Bush. Now, you remember the story. We talked about this. Olmert said he had called Bush, interrupted a lecture that Bush was giving in Philadelphia, and said to the aide to answer the phone, "Get me President Bush on the phone." And when he was told that he was in the middle of a speech, Olmert said, "I didn't care. I needed to talk to him now." So he got to the podium and spoke to me. Now, that's what the Israeli prime minister says. And when he got Bush on the phone, according to Olmert, he told Bush that the U.S. should not vote for the resolution. And Bush then directed Condoleezza Rice to abstain. Olmert added, she was left pretty embarrassed. Now, the U.S. government now is denying it, saying it's 100% not true. Both the State Department and the White House said that Olmert's claim that he had gotten Bush to twist Condoleezza Rice's arm was simply untrue. Sean McCormick with the State Department said that story of what happened is just, quote, 100% totally, completely not true. The White House Deputy Press Secretary Tony Fratto said, quote, there are inaccuracies, end quote. It's astonishing stuff, isn't it? Huh? It's astonishing stuff. Either way, I think it's very clear that Condoleezza Rice's function as Secretary of State was to do what George Bush indicated in one of his more famous racist statements when he said, when people accuse me of not hiring folks, he left out the word black, I just look at Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. Remember that? So I think it's very clear that as talented as Powell and Rice may have been, they certainly weren't talented in the position of Secretary of State. They were both abject failures, worse than failures. They enabled Bush to do what he did. But as talented as they might be in some other area, they certainly were incapable of being Secretaries of State. And Bush knew that. And the people who run Bush knew that. And the function of Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell was to allow Bush to be able to claim that he had colored folks working in very high positions in his administration. Now, I think we're at the point in the history of this country, we all know that the State Department does not run foreign policy. It just doesn't. That's run by the National Security Agency. It's run by the CIA. It's run by the intelligence agencies when they are under the firm control of someone like Dick Cheney. But the State Department does not set foreign policy, nor does it advocate behind closed doors for foreign policy. It is a showpiece office. Now, will it be different with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama? I think so. I'm not saying that that will be a good thing. I think Hillary Clinton's positions on most issues facing the United States are very similar to Dick Cheney's. Disagree? Tell me where they differ. Tell me where they differ. Now, Barack Obama, of course, being a constitutional law professor, I think he will rein in the abuses that have been committed by under the authority of the State Department, and also beyond that to the security agencies and the CIA and so on and so forth. But as far as Hillary Clinton being another Condoleezza Rice or Colin Powell, I don't think so. Both Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, I think it was made very clear to them early on, not with a direct statement, but with the way they were relegated to a secondary or third level decision-making process, that their positions were window dressing. That's all, just window dressing. Here, we'll let you have this incredibly important office in the cabinet of George W. Bush. Just don't expect to exercise the power that comes with the Secretary of State. That will be handled now by Dick Cheney and the national security agencies. It just never stops with these people, does it? I was thinking tonight that I was reading something in Mother Jones. The current issue of Mother Jones has a lot of good stuff in it. If you haven't gotten it, you ought to go pick it up. It's one with Barack Obama on the cover as the New Year's Eve baby walking a tightrope. It's a January, February issue. And it has a bunch of short articles about what the Obama presidency is facing, what it's going to have to do, so on and so forth. One of the things it says is that Barack Obama had created the most technologically innovative, entrepreneurially driven campaigns in American political history. The most, not one of, the most. So here we are, about 10 years after Bill Clinton promised this bridge to the 21st century, Obama is about to drag the entire government into the 21st century. It's about time. And when I read that, he's vowed to bring every federal agency up to current tech standards. Whoa, Jesus, God, you know, the FBI and the CIA still can't talk to each other. The FBI headquarters and the FBI field offices, I believe, still can't talk to each other over the Internet. Incredible stuff. He has appointed the nation's first chief technology officer. And he said that he, quote, wants to, quote, use technology to open up our government and invite all Americans in, end quote. Now, in short, he wants to end Dick Cheney's reign of darkness, you know, with this Internet-powered sunshine. Well, we shall see. The Internet is a monster, just an absolute monster. And once it's unleashed, of course, in any area that heretofore has been secret, that's it. There is no avoiding the penetration of the web. It can penetrate everything, and it will, by its very nature. The Internet, or the gathering of information, the sharing of information, the codifying of information, that's what it is. I mean, that's all it is this interconnected network that seeks to get into the very darkest corners of everything and expose it. And I'm reading these articles in Mother Jones, and I'm thinking, you know, all of a sudden I feel so 20th century. I don't know. It just got me very depressed. You know, I'm still tied, deeply tied to a century that gave us two world wars, depression, nuclear weapons, lies, the Holocaust, the invasion of Palestine. I mean, just on and on and on and on and on. The 20th century, the most bloody century in world history, I guess, certainly in American history. And I get this sense that things are starting to move on. You know what I'm saying? And I feel like the guy who's standing by the side of the road as the trolley goes by and it's raining out, and he's saying, "Hey, wait, hey, psh, hey, wait a minute, wait a minute." And the bus just pulls away.
I'm sure that Europe is a lovely place to visit. My wife would love to go there every single year. But they're just puppies.
Yep, 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 yep.
They need to shut their yaps, the big dogs over here. I will rule the world forever. I'm straight and white and male, American and free.
Condoleezza, check my pussy.
Bill O'Reilly, Diebold Systems, Master Sturge and me.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. I don't mind watching the trolley pull away in the rain. I really don't. But I hope that this power that is the web is going to work as a tool for governance, as well as it did for Barack Obama, as a tool for campaigning and fundraising. I really do. I hope it does. And if it means open government, that's great. And again, there's no way that you can hide things short of having on staff someone who knows how to absolutely purge hard drives of countless numbers of computers. But that's gone. Even that is gone now. It might have been able to do that back in Clinton's day, but not anymore. Somebody died today. I want to mention to you, he was a killer. And Bob Dylan had a song back in the 60s, a song about what this guy did. And his name was William Zantzinger. He was a wealthy Maryland landowner. And he beat a black barmaid. And she died. This is years ago, back in, 1963. He died today at the age of 69. The story is very simply that he was a tobacco farmer. And after causing this woman to die, this black woman, this barmaid, he served 6 months in a county jail. His sentence was delayed 2 weeks so he could harvest his tobacco crop. And he served time for manslaughter in Washington County jail in Baltimore. He struck a 51-year-old barmaid with his cane because she took too long to serve him a drink. The woman's name was Hattie Carroll. She died of a stroke. And Dylan wrote a song entitled The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. And the point of the Dylan song was, of course, to criticize the different standards of justice that was available to whites and blacks. News accounts at the time, and a friend of mine sent this to me today. I do not remember this. But news accounts at the time said Mr. Zantzinger had been drinking with his wife at a dinner before a big white people only ball. And during the dinner, Zantzinger started hitting various waitresses with his cane. When he went on trial, he said to the jury, quote, "Yeah, I'd been smacking, tapping waitresses on the tail, and they didn't say anything. I was just playing," end quote. And he went on to say, quote, "I had no other purpose than to have a good time. The last thing I intended was to harm or injure anyone. I never even thought about it," end quote. Now, later on in his life, after he got out of county jail, he became a foreclosure auctioneer. And in 2001, he spoke with a guy who was writing a book about Bob Dylan, a biographer named Howard Sounds. And he Zantzinger said he should have sued Dylan and put him in jail. Publicist for Bob Dylan said the songwriter has no comment. "I was just playing. I just felt like beating them bitches up, you know, hitting them with my cane. Why not? I'm just playing." Sounds like George Bush, doesn't it? Huh? And I guess you've heard about this. Keith Olbermann had a long piece about this. I hate to sit here right before showtime and see Olbermann just all over the stories that I've selected to do on this program. But a long-awaited Justice Department report about the Civil Rights Division was released, and it talks about the former chief of the Civil Rights Division, some thug named Bradley Schlossman. Oberman had a lot of direct quotes that this sorry bastard statements that he made when he was heading the Civil Rights Division, just an ugly-looking white man whose job was the Civil Rights Division, the Justice Department, is an important position. It's to ensure the rights of minorities, and ensure the rights of women. And Schlossman saw it as a place where he could pack the Civil Rights Division with people who were racist, sexist, who hated the idea of individual rights, much less legal protections for those rights. A little bit more on this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
But you, who philosophize disgrace and criticize fear, take the rag away from your feet. Now ain't the time for your tears. Hattie Carroll was a maid in the kitchen. She was 51 years old and gave birth to 10 children who carried the dishes and took out the garbage and never sat once at the head of the table.
The Mike Malloy Show. You are now entering a flying monkey free zone.
It's about 25 before the hour. Is that from Pulp Fiction? God, that just, all I can, when I hear that music, all I can see is that scene from the bottom of that bicycle shop or whatever, that gun shop. What was that place where, anyway, this Justice Department report, it was put together by the Inspector General, 65-page report. And the author of the report describes Bradley Schlossman, the guy who ran the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, as a staunch conservative who tried to punish liberal employees within the Civil Rights Division, which kind of seems, not only is it illegal what this rat bastard did, but it's just certainly not in keeping with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, is it? The Inspector General's report said, quote, our investigation concluded that Schlossman inappropriately considered political and ideological affiliations in hiring career attorneys and in other personnel actions affecting career attorneys in the Civil Rights Division. We concluded that in doing so, Schlossman violated federal law as well as Justice Department policy, both of which prohibit discrimination in federal employment based on political or ideological affiliations, and committed misconduct, end quote. excuse me. The Inspector General also said, I love the way they put this, faulted Schlossman for his congressional testimony. The report said, our report concluded that Schlossman made false statements about whether he had considered political and ideological affiliations when he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on 5 June 2007 and in his written responses to supplemental questions from the committee, end quote. So he also committed perjury. He committed perjury. He violated federal law. He violated department policy, Justice Department policy. He's not going to be prosecuted. So here you have another Bush vermin thug who did exactly what Cheney and Rove told him to do. Create a permanent Republican majority. Boy, that was short-lived. Kind of like Hitler's thousand-year Reich, huh? Well, that was how long did that last? 9 years. So here's Karl Rove, who wanted to create this evil little snot a permanent Republican majority, and this is how they're going to do it. Not based on Republicans having a better approach to how to conduct the governance of this country or our relations with other countries. Nah, no, nah, that's very antiquated. That's not even 20th century. That's, oh, I don't know, 17th century, 18th, I don't know. All right, post-Enlightenment. But it had nothing whatsoever to do with what these bastards had planned on doing. The permanent Republican majority they were talking about was one based on lies, deception, secret, being secretive, chicanery, duplicity, law-breaking, thuggery, murder, mayhem, wars, deceptions. I mean, this is astonishing, astonishing. This report is the fourth and final one to be issued by the Inspector General. All comes from the ideological firings of the U.S. attorneys by top Justice Department officials. And the allegations, they're not allegations, the facts of extensive improper hiring practices by Republican officials. But the astonishing thing to me is the decision not to prosecute this bastard for all these violations. He committed perjury. I mean, isn't it why Bill Clinton was impeached? Is there any difference? They were both federal employees, right? They both took an oath. They were both under oath when they gave various testimonies. Bill Clinton gets impeached. This little snot, well, he's not little. He's very corpulent, like most of these thugs are. But this snot walks free. Perjury? And if he committed perjury when he was asked questions about his dealings in the Civil Rights Division, that's obstruction. Violated federal law regarding hiring practices, false statements to Congress, on and on and on. Another one who will probably get a pardon from George W. Bush, right? I mean, every single day. And you notice I haven't heard anything about the guy who ran HUD, Housing Urban Development, who quietly resigned a couple of weeks ago, right? We don't even know his name. Do you know his name? No, don't Google it. Don't Wikipedia it. Do you know the name of the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development who resigned? Because it is appearing that his cabinet position, his agency, was, I mean, absolutely filthy with corruption. Can you think of his name? No, you can't. Neither can I. But that was the Karl Rove permanent majority. Lies, thievery, theft, murder, mayhem, deception. Oh, don't look it up and email it to me. Come on, come on, come on. You get my point. You know who Ed Rollins is? He was the political director for Ronald Reagan. He is a Republican strategist. And back during the Republican primary campaigns, he was the national chairman of former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee's presidential campaign. So that's Ed Rollins. He is now a CNN contributor. He has an op-ed piece at CNN online, and you got to listen to some of this. He says, 1 week from today, a historic presidency begins and a tarnished presidency ends. He says the inauguration of Barack Obama cannot come quickly enough for the vast majority of Americans. And then he goes on to say that George Bush, the ever-confident occupant of that high office, seems to be like the dinner guest who will not leave. And then he makes this statement. He says, in all my years around Washington as an observer and as a member of several administrations, I have rarely witnessed an event as bizarre as President Bush's farewell press conference yesterday. The one that we gave you so much about last night, remember? Ed Rollins, see, this is why we cut it up and fed it to you. And a lot of you cut and run said, I want to hear that crap, which is understandable. I understand that. No problem. But the point in dumping that into the airwaves to the extent that we did last night was for the same reason that Ed Rollins felt compelled today to write an op-ed piece for CNN. He says the speech. He said, I've rarely witnessed an event as bizarre as that press conference yesterday. He says, it reminded me of Richard Nixon's November 17th, 1973 Q&A session before 400 Associated Press managing editors at the height of the Watergate scandal, in which he declared, quote, people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook, end quote. Well, I know Dick Nixon wasn't a crook. He was a goddamn mass murderer. Crock, please. So Ed Rollins goes on here to say that the mistakes, and they're not, why do they keep referring to Bush's mistakes? These were conscious decisions. These are not mistakes. These were calculated, thought-out decisions that resulted in chaos, death, destruction, financial ruin, loss of our reputation. But Rollins insists, okay, what the hell, it's your op-ed piece, Ed. The mistakes of his presidency, referring to Bush, were caused by a certain arrogance that was still fully on display yesterday at the press briefing. Rollins goes on to say, how can you reflect on going to war, a war of choice, and argue that, quote, not finding weapons of mass destruction was a significant disappointment, end quote, as Bush did yesterday? And how do you put the not finding the weapons in the same breath as, quote, we shouldn't have hung the sign, mission accomplished, end quote? Rollins says a disappointment is when you're a football fan and your team lost in the playoffs or the national championship game. Eliminating weapons of mass destruction was the rationale for sending hundreds of thousands of men and women to Iraq to risk their lives and spending billions of dollars of American taxpayer money. And George Bush calls not finding weapons of mass destruction a significant disappointment. It's just, I mean, it's hard for me to process this and any of this stuff. And I can't wait till this rat bastard, it becomes a part of history, you know?
One of the parts that really bothered me about the presser yesterday was that no one in the press asked him about his interview with Brit Hume the day before, where he admitted that, well, a couple of white guys sitting around talking about torturing. Yeah, we all were sitting around saying, hey, is this legal? What can we do? Tools we got? Can we do this? What can we do?
You know why that is, Kathy. You've been pulling these sound bites and criticizing the crack White House press corps for 8 years. You know why they didn't say anything. They don't dare. They don't dare ask that kind of a question. The only problem with Rollins' piece, he closes by saying, as we hope for the change, which is coming next week, I just want to pause and reflect and say to President Bush, thank you for serving your country. Oh, my God.
Making the pie higher, it's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. After the break here, we're going to talk about the situation in Gaza when we come back. Prairie 2 writes, regarding high-tech presidents, Obama's a big fan of Abraham Lincoln, who really was the first so-called high-tech president. He quickly embraced the telegraph and was able to keep track of the war in almost real time, as opposed to our victory in the Battle of New Orleans in 1814 that took place 2 weeks after the war ended. Bush learned of the attack on the World Trade Center in real time, but, well, you know. Yeah, I know. A House Democratic report was released yesterday, and it was put together by the Judiciary Committee. And it says the incoming Obama administration should launch a criminal investigation of Bush administration officials to see whether they broke the law in the name of national security. Now, as you know, Obama has been more than cautious on this issue. And as a matter of fact, it appears, and I say this with very few caveats, if any, that there's going to be no criminal investigation through a special prosecutor that would come from the Justice Department or outside the Justice Department, have to be ordered, I guess, by the president. But it's not going to happen. The report put together by the Judiciary Committee, I think it was the Judiciary Committee, it says the along with a criminal probe to find out how much damage and lawbreaking these bastards really did, there should be a September 11th style commission with subpoena power to gather facts and make recommendations on preventing misuse of power. In other words, let's all gather around and thoroughly lock the barn doors. Now all the horses are gone. Gather facts and make recommendations on preventing the misuse of power. That's what the Church Committee, Senator Church's committee, was all about back in, what, 76? Remember that? I do. Because of the egregious abuses of power during the Nixon-Spiro Agnew stomp on the U.S. Constitution, the lies and murder and deceit that was committed by those rat bastards. Remember the Church Commission? What good did it do? Yeah? A little bit of good for maybe 5 years, and then, of course, if that, and then nothing happened. So it went back to the bad old days of spying on Americans, only on a much more sophisticated and all-encompassing basis. You know, back in the day, during Nixon, they listened in on your phone calls, and the way they listened in was with a wiretap, you know, something they would clip to the switching box outside on the telephone pole, right? Or they would open your mail. Don't have to do that anymore. The report issued by the staff of the House Judiciary Committee covers Bush policies that Democrats have been fighting against for some time. And the Democrats are demanding investigations such as the interrogation of foreign detainees, you know, torture, warrantless wiretaps, you know, violation of the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, retribution against critics, the old Soviet Politburo style of governance, manipulation of intelligence. That is criminal misconduct that took us into a war. Political dismissal of U.S. attorneys, you know, on and on and on. This list doesn't get any shorter. As a matter of fact, the list keeps getting longer. Who knew about this Schlotzman or whatever the hell his name is at the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department? What a goddamn joke that was. Only the joke, of course, on the Constitution, on the American people, on folks who, the joke is on folks who desperately needed protection from the abuses that Republicans always dump on minorities or people who can't fight back. That is their game. Republicans are cowards. They're just absolute dry-mouthed cowards when you confront them. So they do this kind of stuff. But the list keeps getting longer and longer and longer. Obama has said that intelligence officials, probably some of the most guilty, because they allowed what they were doing to be totally politicized by Dick Cheney. Obama said intelligence officials were, quote, extraordinarily talented people who are working very hard to keep America safe. I don't want them to suddenly feel like they've got to spend all their time looking over their shoulders and lawyering. What the hell does that mean? Mr. President-elect, what does that mean? Nobody's asking anyone to spend all their time looking all over their shoulders. I think what the Judiciary Committee is asking that these people simply not violate the law. Oh, my. Am I yelling at Barack Obama already? Obama said he has not made a final decision about a September 11th type commission. Oh, yeah, okay. And a criminal probe may need, like we mentioned, a special prosecutor named by the Attorney General. Of course, the Attorney General is appointed and serves at the pleasure of the president, and you see where that's going to go. Welcome back. Malloy here on Nova M Radio. It's about 7 past the hour. We were talking about this a couple of reports issued today. One by the Inspector General of the Justice Department talking about how the Civil Rights Division was turned into an absolute Republican whorehouse by a guy who was supposed to be doing what the law required. And instead, like any Republican, decided to violate the law, break the law, Barry Schlossman. And not only did he commit perjury, obstruction, violated federal hiring laws, just on and on and on, he will not be prosecuted. Well, at least not by this Attorney General. You know, Michael McKay, is Mukasey the Attorney General? Yeah. Here's this guy who's Attorney General. Michael Mukasey is an Orthodox Jew, which means he has great respect, or should, for the law, more so than, say, an Orthodox Protestant who would subscribe more fully, if he were an evangelical Orthodox Protestant, to God's law. And Mukasey will refuse. You watch. There's going to be no prosecution of this guy. The Schlossman broke the law. Okay. Committed perjury. Yeah. What else? Obstruction of justice. Oh, okay. Okay. No prosecution. And also another report issued by the staff of the Judiciary Committee, the Democratic staff, the Judiciary Committee, recommending that the Obama administration should launch a criminal investigation of members of the Bush crime family to find out what laws they broke in the name of national security and the degree to which they have jeopardized the security and safety of this country. And they have. The most important part, I think, of the crimes committed, or the most horrifying aspect of the crimes committed by the Bush administration, has been the fact that they have reduced the security of every single American on earth. They have made us vulnerable to attacks globally. In other words, they have made us more vulnerable, the Bush crime family has, to violence. the exact opposite of what Bush claims. He says his job was to protect the American people. It was not. It was to protect and defend the Constitution. But let's go with what Bush said. If that were the case, then this guy has got to be the most miserable failure in the history of the presidency, just on that one issue alone. No argument there, right? You know, while we over here in the United States, some of us anyway, and in Europe and other parts of the planet, watch and listen to what the Israeli Defense Forces are doing to the civilian population of Gaza, we freak out. We call it wildly disproportionate response. We say it's causing untold human suffering. We are aware that this bombing and murdering is against an already isolated and impoverished population, and that it must be stopped. I mean, anyone with as far as I'm concerned, with any sort of conscience can only come to that conclusion. Guess what? Surprise, surprise, it was to me. In Israel, according to Ethan Bonner, who's writing for the New York Times, International Herald Tribune, very few among the Jewish population in Israel see it the way we see it. And Ethan Bronner says, how can a war that looks so awful, in which, among other atrocities, a civilian crowd near a United Nations school was hit, killing dozens, Red Cross workers were denied access to scores of dead and wounded for days, causing global outrage, how can this be supported by such a vast Israeli public? I don't know. Bronner says, quote, since Israeli warplanes opened the assault on Gaza 18 days ago, voices of dissent in Israel have been rare. And while tens of thousands have poured into the streets of world capitals demonstrating against the military operation, rallies in Israel have been lucky to draw 1,000 people. The Peace Now organization, one of the perhaps the premier organization working towards peace in Israel, the Peace Now organization has received many messages from supporters telling it to stay out of the streets on this one. And as the Jerusalem Post editorial page put it Monday, the world must be wondering, do Israelis really believe that everybody is wrong and they alone are right? The answer is yes. Yoel Estron, who is the editor of a daily business newspaper called Kalkalist in Israel, said, quote, it's very frustrating for us not to be understood. Almost 100% of Israelis feel that the world is hypocritical. Where was the world when our cities were rocketed for 8 years and our soldier, singular, was kidnapped? Why should we care about the world's view now, end quote, when our soldier was kidnapped? Oh, my God. Okay. 900 dead in Gaza, most of them civilians. In Israel now, there are voices of concern that maybe the war is outliving its value. And according to Ethan Bronner, worry is building over the risk to Israeli troops and even more civilian casualties as the ground war escalates. But, as Bronner writes, that is distinctly a minority view. Polls show that nearly 90% support the war thus far. And interviews confirm that Israelis not only favor it, but do so strongly. So, why doesn't the death toll of hundreds of children, hundreds of innocent civilian adults, why doesn't that cause the kind of revulsion in Israel that it does abroad? Well, there's an answer. The editorial page editor of the Jerusalem Post, Elliot Jager, said, quote, this is a just war, and we don't feel guilty when civilians we don't intend to hurt get hurt, because we feel Hamas uses these civilians as human shields. We do feel bad about it, but we don't feel guilty. He goes on to say the most ethical, moral imperative is for Israel to prevail in this conflict over an immoral Islamist philosophy. It is a zero-sum conflict. That is what is not understood outside this country, end quote. And if you've been following any of the news tonight, you know what is happening. The Israeli military is pushing deeper and deeper and deeper into the Gaza, which is, Jesus, I think at its widest point, it's what, 25 miles? Gaza City is surrounded. The bombing and the killing goes on. This is like the shock and awe attack that the United States initiated against Iraq. No regard whatsoever. I don't give a damn what these military thugs say, whether they're or the planners, whether they are Israeli or American or Russian. It doesn't make any difference. Well, you know, we try to avoid civilian populations. No, you don't. No, you don't. Of course you don't. Because you use the same tactic of terror against a civilian population that the people you label as terrorists use against you. So don't pretend that you try to avoid civilian casualties. That is a filthy lie. Moshe Halbertal, a left-leaning professor of philosophy at the Hebrew University, according to Eric Bronner, helped write the Army's ethics code. And he said he knows from personal experience how much discussion has gone into deciding when it is acceptable to shoot at a legitimate target, even if civilians are nearby. And he adds that there have been several events in this war where he suspects, the ethics writer, the wrong decision was made. But it doesn't mean anything. I mean, let's face it, Palestinians are not really people. They couldn't be. They couldn't be people. If they were people, the urge by civilized nations around the world to end this would be much stronger than it is, wouldn't it?
Hey, neocons, don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's more Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. The the attitude, according to what Ethan Bronner has written in today's New York Times and, I'm sorry, yesterday's New York Times and International Herald Tribune, which is the international edition of New York Times. You knew that. I'm not trying to show off. You knew that. What he has written is that the people in Israel, the civilian population or the population of Israel, is completely, totally, nearly 100% behind this invasion of the hellhole that is known as Gaza. I have not been to Gaza. I was invited to go on the Eyewitness Israel program several years ago. A bunch of years ago. Oh, my God. That was about 15 years ago. And for various reasons, 20 years ago, for various reasons, could not go. But again, I've made it a point to stay as informed as I possibly can about the issues between the Palestinians and Israelis. I get a lot of emails from jackasses who have read maybe 1/100th what I have read regarding this issue. Not that I'm a scholar, I'm not, but I've tried to inform myself as to what the situation is. The history, whether it is a long ago history or history since the 1900s or 1948 or whatever. And I get emails from crackpots who try to tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. And to most of those people, I just give them the middle finger, metaphorically speaking, or I write back to them and tell them to go F themselves and move on. I really do. But I can't understand with all the devotion, is that the right word, that I have with all the interest that I have used to try to educate myself about this situation, I can't understand what it is about Gaza. Gaza is a concentration camp. That's all it is. The Israelis have kept the population of Gaza in a near state of paralysis. See, we don't know what really, unless we go to the foreign press, because the American press, to a great extent, unless a war breaks out, does not cover the issue of Gaza. 1.5 million people there who are treated like animals. They're not treated like human beings. Medical help denied, food denied, clean water denied, sewage denied, everything denied. Oh, God, I get so tired of this. And it's not about me. And it has nothing to do with me. It's about the people who are suffering in that part of the world. I've tried to establish clearly that I think blowing up a bus or bombing a village or attacking civilians by anybody, at any time, anywhere on earth, is a crime against humanity. And I've also wrestled with the idea, and I know a lot of the people who email me this garbage about, yeah, you son of a bitch, you don't know what you're talking about, have not wrestled with this. What constitutes, I mean, to what degree is a population, should a population be committed to and dedicated to resistance when it is occupied? I mean, there have been volumes written about this. I don't know. I know what I would do in this country were I to be occupied by what I consider to be a foreign power. I would resist, and it would be very quick because I would be killed early on. Very early on. You know, I'm not the type who would be part of an underground. I'm the type that would pick up a weapon and find the nearest invader or oppressor or occupier and try to kill him. And then I would probably be killed in return. It's very quick, very simple. I have no doubt about that about myself. But it's not about me. I just use that as a reference. I cannot understand why everybody gets so surprised when the Gazans launch rockets into, quote, the territory of the what they see as the occupier, the oppressor, the invader. Well, I mean, and it doesn't make any difference what you think, gentle listener, and it doesn't make any difference what I think. The only salient point here is that the Palestinians feel invaded, occupied, denied. I mean, do you realize how long Palestinians have been living in refugee camps? Try 60 years. I mean, Jesus Christ, is there any place on earth where people have been in refugee camps for 3 generations? I'm sure there must be. But where are they? You got any comments about this? We'll take some phone calls. Even if you are absolutely in agreement with the people of Israel, the Jewish population of Israel, that these Palestinians just need to have their asses kicked up around their heads, give us a call.
Because life's too short to listen to right-wing radio, it's more of Mike Malloy.
Amira Haas is an Israeli journalist and author. She's mostly known for her columns in Haaretz, the daily newspaper there. She is the daughter of Holocaust survivors. I think both of her parents were Holocaust survivors. She has pissed off the Palestinians and the Israelis because of her reporting. Her opinions run counter to both official Israel and Palestinian positions. But she has lived in Gaza, and she's also lived in Ramallah. She has reported from the Palestinian territories for a number of years. She's someone whose writings you have to respect. She is not anti-Israel. She was born there. She is Israeli. She's a journalist, and like I said, her parents were both Holocaust survivors from Bergen-Belsen, of all places. She was educated at Hebrew University. She studied the history of Nazism and the reaction of the European left to the Holocaust. I've quoted her many times. Here's the latest. Amira Haas writing in Haaretz. She writes, a 28-year-old Palestinian doctor in the Gaza refugee camp of Jabalia was killed by Israeli Defense Forces while on his way to remove casualties from a building being targeted by Israeli missiles, according to the Mizan Human Rights Group in Gaza. His death raises the death toll of medical personnel killed by the IDF to 7 since December 27th. In addition, 3 hospitals and 4 health clinics were damaged by heavy gunfire in the last few days. Dr. Issa Sala, a member of the Palestinian Civil Defense Services, and his team reached the building. That's the guy who was killed, where the casualties were located around 4:30 p.m. yesterday, a few minutes after it was hit by a missile fired by an Israeli helicopter. The residents ran out, having learned that the first such missile is a warning to residents to evacuate the building before additional missiles demolish it. Not everyone made it out in time. An 18-year-old girl was killed, and 4 residents, including 2 children, were wounded in the second missile strike. Dr. Sala was killed, and one of his colleagues wounded in the third missile strike while on their way to remove the woman and the 4 residents from the site and get them medical treatment. Meanwhile, the dead woman's 23-year-old sister and another woman, 20, were also killed in the continuing Israeli shelling of that particular building. 5 others were wounded. Dr. Sala's death underscores the difficulty Palestinians face in removing casualties from the scene. To claim victimhood, as the Israelis are doing, when your death toll is 13 and your enemy's death toll is approaching 1,000, I don't get this. There must be some part of this that I'm missing, and I've tried to talk this over with Jewish friends here in Atlanta, with the Palestinian friends here in Atlanta. But I'm left completely blank, and I wish I did understand it, because, well, I don't know. Why do you wish you understood it, or don't you? The idea in this country where it concerns the Palestinians is to ignore them. They don't exist. It's pretty scary when the editorial page editor of the Jerusalem Post, at least it's scary to me, says the most ethical moral imperative is for Israel to prevail in this conflict over an immoral Islamist philosophy. He says that is what is not understood outside this country. When Israel killed the top Hamas ideologue, Ethan Bronner writes, remember that, Nizar Rayan, in the first week of the war? And the airstrike also killed his four wives and nine of his children at the same time. Jesus Christ. And as Ethan Bronner writes, almost no one in Israel publicly questions the decision to drop a bomb on this guy's house and kill nine children. It's all the attention in Israel was on how satisfying and just it was to kill a man whose ideology and activity had been so virulent and destructive. Well, the writer A.B. Yehoshua, who opposes Israel's occupation and promotes a Palestinian state, has spent the past 2 weeks trying to explain the war to foreigners. This is what he says. Imagine, I tell a French reporter, that every 2 days a missile falls in the Champs-Élysées and only the glass windows of the shops break and five people suffer from shock. What would you say if you were French? Wouldn't you be angry? Wouldn't you send missiles at Belgium if it were responsible for missiles on your Grand Boulevard? End quote. Well, I think what Mr. Yehoshua leaves out is what, I mean, supposing France is occupying Belgium and starving the Belgians to death and preventing access to the sea, even though Belgium is on the coast, isn't it? I don't have a map in front of me. Isn't it? Just like Gaza is. What if you were denying the Belgians medical care, medical supplies, clean water, garbage pickup, sewage removal? What if you had occupied Belgium for 60 years? So, you know, the analogy here, far be it from me to correct as great a personage as the writer A.B. Yehoshua, but is not Mr. Yehoshua leaving out in his comparison of Belgium and France, Palestine and Israel, is he not leaving out a very critical element? Seems to me he is, but what do I know, right? Is anybody on the phone for this particular topic? Do we have, let me take a look here at the, let's do Scott. Scott is calling from Santa Cruz, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Mike. So, you know, I've been trying to puzzle this thing out the whole time it's been going on, and it's tough to, I mean, there's obviously two sides to this, and I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, you can look at, how things are going in the rest of the Palestinians, and it seems like they've forged somewhat of a peace with Israel, you know, and still being in somewhat of a relationship of an occupied country, but without the rocket strikes, it seems like they are receiving, a decent level of treatment from Israel, certainly different than what Hamas has.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes you wonder, I mean, if they were to stop firing the rockets, could there be some sort of peace that would be worth fighting for or working toward?
Well, as we played last night in the program, a sound clip of the spokesman for Prime Minister Olmert, there was a truce in place between Hamas and specifically Gaza and the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, or the Israeli government. And the Israeli government broke the truce by attacking inside Gaza and killing six people who the IDF said were Hamas fighters. And that ended the truce. So,
and
go ahead.
What was the date of that?
That was back, I believe, in December. I think it was in December.
Weren't the rockets already being fired from Gaza at that time?
I can send you, if you will send me an email, I'll send you a link to a video that has Mark Regev, a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister, admitting that Israel broke the ceasefire truce, not Hamas.
I did hear about that quote.
Right. So it's there if you want to see it. And also, it's a BBC report, and the BBC also uses – it's only like a minute and a half a video, and the BBC uses graphs to show how the rocket fire into Israel – and, yes, of course Hamas has been firing rockets into southern Israel. It's my understanding from everything I get my hands on, including official Israeli reports of this, though. And I don't mean to minimize one single death, but six Israelis killed over the past, or eight Israelis killed by these rockets over the past 7 or 8 years, which is not to justify it at all. But the idea of proportionality. Hold on a second. Just stay there a minute. We'll come back and finish up in a second, Scott. You got a minute? Okay, I guess we have him on hold. Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk with Scott.
And now a soothing bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
My name is Luca. 10 before the hour, we're talking with Scott in Santa Cruz. All right, Scott, where were we?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, Mike. Well, you know, let me put it this way. What I've been wondering is what are the rockets accomplishing that Hamas is sending? Because they're obviously not much of a strategic military operation. And I think if they were just to really kind of throw up their hands and just let the world really see that they were the fact that they're fighting back at all, they're not achieving much, and just letting the world see exactly what a massacre this really is, would really help their cause, I believe. That, you know, the media would have trouble putting it out the way they're attempting to skew it. If Hamas was to stop firing these rockets, the media wouldn't be able to skew it the way they are. So what are they getting out of it? Why not stop?
I can't answer because I have never lived under an occupation. And I'm guessing that, I don't know your history, but I'm guessing that neither have you.
This is true.
All I can do is kind of get involved here in conjecture, as the Bush crime family is fond of saying, hypotheticals. If I had been forced to live in the kind of denigration and denial of my humanity as the Gazans have been forced to live, the Palestinians have been forced to live for over 60 years now. You know, we can make all the claims we want to about whose God gave Israel to which one of these tribes. You know, the theologians can argue that until their hell freezes over. But the fact is, there was an indigenous population in what was called, at least for a while, Palestine. And that indigenous population was forced out when Jews from around the world, during and after World War II, emigrated to Israel, to the strip of land they designated as Eretz Israel, although they don't have that completely yet. But it's much the same as what we did. And this, of course, they did because God gave them that land, just like God determined that white Europeans had manifest destiny in this country, and we had a right to come here and murder and butcher and end the lives of hundreds of thousands of indigenous people here. So, I don't have any answers for this. All I can say, and I've quoted this guy so many times, Meir Kahane, who was a member of the Koch party in Israel, which was an extreme right-wing party. He was born in this country. He was part of the JDL, Jewish Defense League, that was organized, I think, in New Jersey. He was a hard-ass dude, Meir Kahane. He was a rabbi, as were many members of his family, male members of his family. He went to Israel. He was a member of parliament, and he wrote a book entitled They Must Go, the they being the Palestinians. There was a rally in New York City over the weekend where the speakers, including people like Senator Charles Schumer and Governor David Patterson, are calling for the extermination. People at the rally were calling for the mass killing of all Palestinians. Now, goddammit, I don't care, Scott, what your position is on any of this stuff. This is insanity. When Meir Kahane, a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, he was assassinated in New York at a restaurant, By an Egyptian, I believe. But when a rabbi says the indigenous people of Palestine saw the Jew come from Warsaw, from Brooklyn, from Kiev, from Johannesburg, and show up and say, "Get out! God gave us this land 5,000 years ago," of course the Palestinians are going to say no. And there is going to be conflict. Meir Kahane said this.
Right.
And he said, of course they're going to resist. And of course they're going to fight us. That's why we must kill them all. Now,
well, what I'm saying is that...
I'm not sure I understand what...
What I'm saying is the Palestinians are facing such an overwhelming military force.
What should they do then? I mean, Obviously,
it's very different. Like you said, if I was living in an occupied territory, I'd have a different experience, especially if my family and neighbors were being decimated by American-made missiles left and right. However, you know, I think that since they have no chance at military success, if they were to lay down their arms and sort of make a plea, sort of a humanitarian as well as public relations plea to just show that they are in no way the aggressor and cannot at all be labeled the aggressor, it seems like it would have to work in their favor and work better than it is now, because they're not extracting much of a toll with the rockets they're sending now, and all that could really happen is that a lot of people who use that as an excuse right now, whether it's Israeli defense or American supporters or politicians, they would no longer have that as an excuse. And I obviously, you know, if you're living in that situation, you're going to use any means necessary out of frustration. But it seems to me that if cooler heads were to prevail, that would be a much more effective strategy for the.
But aren't you saying that, for example, it would have been better for black people in this country in the 40s, 50s, and 60s to just say, okay, look, white folks. You're stronger than we are. You have all the weapons. What does he want us to do? Well, we want you to ride in the back of the bus, shut your mouths, clean up our toilets, take care of our old people, and don't ever even consider the idea of voting or living. Living in a country where you are represented in the Congress or in either house.
Well, I'm speaking of exactly the. That's what made me think of this.
Isn't that what you're saying? That if the Palestinians would only wake up and realize that they are less than the Israeli Jews, and that Israel is a Jewish state, and therefore the Palestinians, whether they're Christian or a Muslim or whatever they are, that their only response to all this is to lay down, play dead, be good dog. And hope that the Israelis will stop killing them. All right, I've got to go. Scott, I have to leave it there. We're flat out of time.
Martin Luther King didn't lay down, and Mahatma Gandhi didn't lay down.
I've got to go. I do. We'll come back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back at the 7 past the hour. We've gotten a lot of requests from people who would like to see that BBC video. I'll tell you where you can go very quickly. TVNewsLies.org, one of my favorite websites for news of all sorts. TVNewsLies.org. Go to their homepage, and near the top of the homepage, you'll see a box with news, 9/11 news, Congress, economy, editorials, energy. The last category is war. Click on war, and you will have access to the video of Mark Regev, who is a spokesman for Ehud Olmert, admitting that Israel broke the ceasefire truce, not Hamas. And I said this the other night. Why is this not shown on American television news? Why is it not talked about on American radio news? Why is it not part of the discussion on American talk radio? Why does NPR not talk about it? Why is it not on the front page of the New York Times, Washington Post, or any other newspaper? It's astonishing. The official statement of the Israeli government is Hamas did not break the truce. Go to TVNewsLies.org. TVNewsLies.org. Go to the homepage. And near the top, click on the little word that says war. And the information is there for you. If you're interested. Andre writes in regarding Scott. He said, "Sir, I hear the argument from the Jewish community all the time. Palestinians, do not fight back as we kill your children, your mothers, your grandparents. We take your homes and we starve you. You will shut up." I said, "Shut up," as my hand blocks your oxygen intake. Isn't that the very definition of authoritarianism? Or worse? Yeah. Okay. Joe writes, "Mike, can you make sense of the international condemnation of Russia's invasion of Georgia and the international complicity of Israel's invasion of Gaza? It seems both countries claim it was for self-defense purposes, yet one was morally condemned and the other was morally justified." Well, back to your phone calls. We're going to skip around here, and Ian is handling the calls tonight. Let's go to line three. Paul is calling from Oklahoma, listening on Sirius. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mike, how are you? Maybe I misunderstood the caller, Scott, but I have got to ask this question, Mike. Is he trying to say because we have the bigger guns and Israel has the bigger guns, we have the right to have any rights we want, also have the right to oppress other people's rights? Is that what he was trying to say?
I think I
misunderstood it.
Well, that is what he was saying, but let's put it in what I think is the context of what Scott was saying, and that was Scott was trying to come up with, I think Scott, like most people who think or have emotions, is sick of the killing. And I think Scott's sympathies probably lie with the civilians who are murdered no matter what side of any line they happen to be on. And I think what Scott was doing was taking a look at the fact that the Israelis are a billion times more powerful in every way imaginable than the Palestinians. The only thing the Palestinians have, they can throw rocks. And now they have these essentially homemade rockets that they lob into the territory Israel claims as its own. So I think what Scott was saying, if the Israelis aren't going to stop, if the Americans aren't going to make them stop, if the Jordanians and the Russians and the Egyptians are not going to make them stop, maybe the Palestinians should just roll over and say, okay, what do you want us to do? I don't think he was justifying it, unless I misheard him. So, you know.
Well, let me just give him a little piece of history from another nation. If my ancestors, and I'm Greek, right? If my ancestors were to take that attitude, I'd be Turkish right now, and they would have never freed our country after 400 years of occupation. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I don't understand why people have to give up who they are in order to please an aggressor. I mean, it's like the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. I don't believe we should be there. I don't believe we had any right to be there. And I honestly don't think Israel has a right to do what they're doing. They have a right to exist, but they don't have a right to oppress and to kill other people just so that they can have the right to exist and live the way they want.
Well, I hear what you're saying, Paul. All right, let me. I appreciate your comments. Let me move on. Thanks, Paul.
Okay.
All right. I appreciate it. Paul is calling from Canton, Georgia, listening on the internet. A second, I believe this is it. Paul.
Yes.
Oh, hey, Paul.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm all right.
I thought Scott was a little misinformed too, because even if the Palestinians were to lay down and do what he said, with all the money that AIPAC flows into this country on the Israeli side, you wouldn't hear about it. Excuse me, I'm a little nervous. Hear about it anyway. I mean, I have different satellite dishes here, and I watch news from, you know, Al Jazeera and CBC, BBC, Press TV, and the coverage is unbelievable compared to what we get over here.
Oh, it is.
I mean, they don't even have to bias the news. They just show you what's going on. You can see how horrific it is. As opposed to here, where you get nothing, and they give one side of the story that's the opposite of what's really happening. And as your the email ran too, I was going to bring up about the Russian response, how they said it was so overboard and everything, and yet the Israelis are doing the same thing, and it seems to be okay.
This issue, the so-called Middle East, this cancer, is. You know, I sent an email to somebody tonight. I have 100 years from now, we're probably, not us, but people will still be talking about, well, Jesus, you hear about the latest Israeli incursion or the latest bombing in Tel Aviv by suicide bombers, that it's never going to be settled. For one reason is because it's a religious war.
Right.
And when you have religious wars, nobody wins until one side is completely gone. This is why, according to the Bible, God said to Joshua, cross over the Jordan River, go into the land of Canaan, and kill everybody. Kill every single one of them. The men, the women, the children, the pregnant people, butcher them. Kill their asses, kill their cows, kill their sheep, kill their grandmothers, kill them all. Now, when you have that sort of thing, when you have Christian fundamentalists who say essentially the same thing, only the Christians take it one step further. Christians say, if we can't kill you all, you're still condemned to everlasting hell once you die for all eternity. The Islamists, the Islamic fundamentalists, essentially say the same thing. If you don't believe in Allah, if you are not a member of the Muslim faith, you are an infidel. We are going to kill you. I mean, the stinking religions. This is the problem. This is the problem here. So. 100 years from now, if there's anybody left alive in that little strip of land in the eastern Mediterranean that's referred to as Israel/Palestine, they will still be figuring out ways to cut each other's throats. It's horrifying. Paul, I got to leave there. Thanks. I appreciate you checking in. We'll be back after the break.
Was the greatest show.
And now, the man conservatives love to hate, it's Mike Malloy.
It's about 21 past the hour. You want some breaking news here, sort of? This is posted at Huffington Post. Who put this up? Sam Stein? Was it Sam Stein? I think it was. Yeah. About 2 hours ago. This is what it says. Barack Obama took the next big step in his Republican charm offensive Tuesday night when he dined with several of the nation's most prominent conservative pundits. The president-elect arrived at the Chevy Chase home, Maryland home, of syndicated columnist George Will shortly after 6:30, according to a press pool report. Greeting him at the residence were other luminaries of the conservative commentariat, including the Weekly Standard's William Kristol, New York Times columnist David Brooks, Charles Krauthammer of the Washington Post. This odd couple gathering led to speculation that Rush Limbaugh, who said that he was in D.C. for a secret meeting, was also in attendance. The talk show host wrote on his website, quote, "I'm just offering a personal trip. Nobody even has to know about this," end quote. But a source close to the transition confirms Limbaugh was definitely not in attendance during the dinner affair, likely disappointing some in the conservative blogosphere, knowing full well the fury that would have caused among progressives. Nevertheless, Obama's choice of dining partners seemed likely to cause its fair share of hair pulling and eye rolling, as the pool reporter Ken Bazinet of the New York Daily News penned in his write-up, quote, "This is for real, folks. The bloggers are going to love this one," end quote. Obama has pledged to be a uniter once in office. He's also said he is willing to take policy suggestions from any source, regardless of ideological affiliation, as long as they work. Bob writes in, Mike, I think AIPAC and the economic political muscle they exercise over the Congress and the media is why we are not hearing the story. There are some honest news providers like Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! That are telling the truth. But notice how stories broken by Democracy Now! Are completely ignored by the mainstream media. Yeah, and Amy Goodman qualifies as a self-hating Jew. You say she's Jewish, and when Amy Goodman presents in as balanced as you can get. I mean, you know, we can all say there's two sides to every story, but if I'm walking down the street and a 4-year-old comes by, and I start beating the 4-year-old into a bloody mass on the ground until the police come and stop me just short of killing the 4-year-old, am I to say there are two sides to the story? My side, or the child's side, is that I just attacked him and beat him almost to death. My side is I don't like children. I realize that's rather asinine, juvenile attempt to show that, in my opinion anyway, sometimes there are not two sides to every story. Is there? Maybe there is. But not in my universe. There are two sides to most stories or incidents or events, but not always. Amy Goodman is the closest thing, I think, that America has to mainstream media that tells the truth. And I realize that Amy Goodman does not fully qualify, although she is on the Pacifica stations. And, of course, as you probably know also, those stations were put together several decades ago by the War Resisters League, if I remember right. And they've maintained, there's only five of them, but those five stations, because of the power of their signal and the demographic area, or the population areas that they're in, I think they have the power or the potential ability to reach like 70% of the population of the country or 60%. It's a big number. So Max Blumenthal, who happens to be Jewish, writing at Alternet, this is posted today, says on January 11th, that would be Saturday, Sunday, an estimated 10,000 people rallied in front of the Israeli consulate in Midtown New York in support of Israel's attack on the Gaza Strip. The rally, which was organized by the UJA, Federation of New York, and the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York, in cooperation with the Conference of Presidents and major American Jewish organizations, the rally featured speeches by New York's most senior lawmakers. While the crowd was riled to righteous anger by speeches about Hamas evildoers, the event was a festive affair that began and ended with singing and joyous dancing. Senator Chuck Schumer highlighted Israel's supposed humanitarian methods of warfare by pointing to its text messaging of certain Gaza Strip residents, urging them to vacate their homes before Israeli forces bombed them. Schumer shouted from the podium, "What other country would do that?" More on this when we come back.
Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live and live? Cause out on the edge of darkness, there is a beast pain.
Border to border and coast to coast, The Mike Malloy Show. All substance, no abuse.
Open your eyes, time to wake up. Enough is enough, is enough, is enough. Open your eyes, time to wake up.
Once again, if you want to see the video, it's only minute 20. Taken from a BBC newscast where the reporter is interviewing Mark Regev, towards the end of it, who is the official spokesman for Ehud Olmert, the Israeli prime minister, admitting that Israel broke the ceasefire truce this time, not Hamas. If you want to see that, go to TV News Lies, tvnewslies.org. Go to their homepage, and up near the top, there is a subject box. Well, not the top, but upper third of the page is the subject box. And you'll see a little word, war. Click there, and you'll get access to this this video. It's on YouTube, but I don't know how to tell you to get there. So go to tvnewslies.org, and it's right there. Max Blumenthal, again, at Alternet, reporting on this huge rally, 10,000 people on a Sunday, is a huge rally. In front of the Israeli consulate, it was a pro-Israel rally. Chuck Schumer, as Max writes, highlighted Israel's supposed humanitarian methods of warfare by pointing that it text messages certain Gaza Strip residents, urging them to vacate their homes before Israeli forces bomb them. And Schumer screams, "What other country would do that?" Which obviously raises the question, who in Gaza has telephones, cell phones that you can text message? I don't get this. Then Governor David Patterson appeared on stage, Max writes, wearing one of the red hats distributed to demonstrators as symbols of the red alerts some residents of Israel endure when Palestinian groups fire rockets their way. Patterson cited the many Qassam rockets that have fallen on Israel as a justification for the country's operations in Gaza, a military assault that has resulted in over 800 casualties and thousands of injuries. It's approaching 1,000 dead now. Blumenthal goes on, then Patterson highlighted the anti-Semitism that has followed in the wake of Israel's attack on Gaza, highlighting the beating of a teenage girl in France. Patterson said, quote, this kind of anger and hatred spreads like a disease, and the one thing I've always pointed out is there's no place for hate in the Empire State, end quote. But, Max Blumenthal writes, hatred was plentiful at the rally Patterson addressed. Right in front of the stage, a man held a banner reading, Islam is a death cult. Rally attendees described the people of Gaza to me as a cancer, called for Israel to, quote, wipe them all out, end quote, insisting, quote, they are forcing us to kill their children in order to defend our own children, end quote. A young woman told me, quote, those who die are suffering God's wrath. Another one said they are not distinguishing between civilians and military, so why should we? That was from a member of the group of Messianic Orthodox Jewish Shabab Lubavitch group that flocked to the rally. I thought the Orthodox Jews, wait a second, see, this is where I get very concerned. The Orthodox Jews, it was my understanding, believe that only the Messiah can establish the state of Israel, and the Messiah to the Orthodox Jews has not arrived. Never mind, I don't know. Anyway, Blumenthal goes on, no one I spoke to could seem to find any circumstance in which they would begin to question Israel's war. No number of civilian deaths, no displays of extreme suffering, nothing could deter their enthusiasm for attacking one of the most vulnerable populations in the world with the world's most advanced weaponry. There are no limits, no matter what Israel does, no matter how it does it. The rally made me think, Max Blumenthal writes, of a passage in the book, The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from the Ashes, a powerful new book by former Israeli Knesset speaker and Jewish National Fund chairman Avraham Berg. Here's the quote. If you are a bad person, a whining enemy, or a strong-arm occupier, you are not my brother, even if you are circumcised, observe the Sabbath, and do mitzvahs. If your scarf covers every hair in your head for modesty, you give alms and do charity, but what is under your scarf is dedicated to the sanctity of Jewish life, taking precedence over the sanctity of human life, whosoever life that is, then you are not my sister. You might be my enemy. A good Arab or a righteous Gentile will be a brother or sister to me. A wicked man, even of Jewish descent, is my adversary, and I would stand on the other side of the barricade and fight him to the end. Mm-hmm. I get that. Do you? Sure you do. Back to your phone calls. Ian, let's go to line four. Abdullah is calling from Washington, D.C., listening on the Internet. Abdullah, welcome to the program.
Mr. Malloy, this is an honor, sir.
Well, okay.
yeah, I've followed you as often as I could, and I really try to listen to you when major world topics like this come about. Like I told you, screener, I want to commend you for being the only man in all media, American, Caucasian, who has the guts to come out of his face and actually say the truth. I have to commend you on that, seriously.
Well, okay. I don't think I'm doing anything radical or revolutionary. These stories are these stories. But I hear what you're saying. I'm not a fool. I live in America.
You yourself have said that no media personality at all has come close to revealing anything that you yourself have done within the last 5, 10, or 20 minutes.
Well, somebody sent me an email and said that Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, who is also Jewish, yeah, has been talking about, in a very critical way, this attack by the IDF. I don't know, but because I very seldom get to see a show. But if that's the case, that's a good thing, too, that Jon Stewart would be pointing out the obvious, that what is going on there is, by anybody's definition, even Israel's definition, the United States definition, by anybody's definition, is a massive crime against humanity. I can't believe it.
But as an American, do you really equate the manifest destiny that the early settlers used to, I guess you could say, tame this country, the same rationale that the Israelis are using?
Only in the sense that both of them said the people that believed in manifest destiny in this country, in other words, it was a gift from God to come to this country, destroy the indigenous population, and establish white European presence here. Same with the Jews of Israel. It is God's, it pleases God for the Jews to go back to end the diaspora, to go back to Israel and establish, regardless of who's there, the sovereignty over the land that God gave them. So it's a weak analogy. I'm just saying both of these instances have to do with people who claim that they are doing what they are doing because God gave them permission or gave them a directive, sort of like George Bush saying that God told him to invade Iraq. I mean, being the complete non-believer in religious mythology of any sort, Jewish, Islam, Christian, Hindu, I appreciate those religions until they become weapons. You know, when people start beating other people with the Quran or the Bible or the cross, that's when I say adios, goodbye, thanks for all the fish, I'm out of here. So I this puts me in a real minority, Abdullah. You understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I see the connection between both analogies, absolutely. Being religious or not, I hope the majority of your listeners can see or at least feel the plight for the Palestinians. And the gentleman that called not too long ago, I guess trying to equate the civil rights movement and how the Palestinians should take the similar circumstances, say, as Gandhi, and to be peaceful and just lay down and I guess love will solve the way. Let's wake up. And that's not realistic. That's not.
Well, I don't know anymore. When empires were breaking up at the end of World War I and World War II, passive resistance seemed to have worked. When the civil rights movement took hold in this country, it seemed to work, but I don't know anymore. I really don't. Abdullah, thanks for calling. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M. Ten before the hour, thanks to Ian Huff, who engineered and answered your calls, Ben Birch, our podcast manager and technical advisor, our military affairs correspondent is Sharon Gordy, our economic advisor is Bruce Enberg, this program's ethical advisors are Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf, Catherine Bay is the executive producer. Email from Hassan. Mike, you've probably heard by now that the mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villaraigosa, has gone out of his way to let people know he is in full support of the Israeli massacre in Gaza. I'm so sorry I voted for him. Rumor has it he has to satisfy his Jewish supporters from very wealthy West L.A. I'm sure he's going to run for governor and needs their money. Yeah, politics is about money no matter where you get it, right? It's really really not pleasant stuff. What else we got here? Back to your phone calls with the few minutes we have left. Let's see. Line 5, Ian. Mike is calling from Tampa, listening on Sirius. Mike, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm all right.
You know, people keep saying that the media is not really telling the truth, and I sort of have to disagree with that, because a lot of the truths that I've found are told by the media, but they're only told like once, whereas something, some other part of the story that they want you to, that they want ingrained in your mind, is told 10, 15, 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those are what I think a lot of people forget is how this all started. And, you know, with Yasser Arafat dying and then having this democratic election that got the president Abbas in charge, and, you know, he was the favored guy. He was the guy favored by Israel and by America to be the replacement for Yasser Arafat, who was just a corrupt guy who kept the status quo. You know, and then a year later, they go to elect a parliament, and Hamas gets the majority of the votes. And the part of the story that I don't seem to hear really anything about, hardly ever, is that when that happened, Israel withheld $100 million in taxes that they collected on behalf of the Palestinians.
Yeah, that's
true. I
don't know
if you remember that.
Yes, I do. And I think another thing that most Americans have no earthly idea, because we are grossly ignorant about our own history, much less history of the Middle East. But Hamas is more or less a creation of the Israelis, of the government of Israel. It was kind of a naked attempt to cause conflict, to destabilize the moderate Palestinian leadership, the PLO, the PLA, Fatah. Hamas has a religious bent. They are messianic, that's a wrong word, but let me use it anyway just to make the point. Messianic Islamists. Fatah is not. The PLO was not. The PLA was not, is not. But Hamas is. So Israel's support of and creation of Hamas is not unlike the U.S. support of and creation of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, that we created, funded, armed, trained to fight the Soviet Union when it invaded Afghanistan. And then the Mujahideen turns around and bites the United States on the ass repeatedly, and is the reason there is Taliban, and is the reason there the destabilization of Pakistan has gotten to the point where there may be nukes in the hands of people who couldn't care less about what happens to the world. So Hamas is to Israel what the Mujahideen was and is to the United States. And doesn't this often happen? Remember Mary Shelley's book about Dr. Frankenstein and the monster he created. All he wanted to do was create life. It's alive. It's alive. And look what happened. You know what I'm saying?
All he wanted to do was kill.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know. It seems like everybody else forgets what happened after that, too. You know, I mean, after 2 months and they couldn't pay their teachers and their doctors and whatnot, that Abbas said it was Hamas's fault and he was dissolving parliament. And that's how the whole big fight between Fatah and Hamas started out, and how they split, you know, from Fatah being in the West Bank and Hamas being in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems most people, they're woefully ignorant of that. You know, they just think that all this stuff happened. And, oh, well, you know, the Palestinians, they elected them into power, and they're such bad people, so they deserve to die.
Yeah, this is what can happen when you offer people the rudimentary ideas of democracy. It is not democracy that brought Hamas to power in Gaza. It is the ability to vote for a slate of candidates, but it's certainly not democracy. A democratic society does not vote into power openly religious fanaticism. It just doesn't happen. And I would be the first to say, with my usual amount of contempt for all three of these religions of the book, that Hamas is a religious fanatic organization, just like the State of Israel is a religious fanatic organization. Come on, it's its own charter. It is a Jewish state. Iran is an Islamic state. On and on and on. Look at the trouble in Northern Ireland. Nothing compared to other places on where religions have clashed. But just an example that white people might be able to understand a little bit, white Christians, the murder, the bombing, the slaughter of innocents between the Protestants and the Catholics in Northern Ireland. Hey, listen, I got to leave it there. Thanks, Mike. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.